Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. On the program today, our Friday roundup, because it's Friday. We'll take a trip to the grocery store and we'll take an e-bike ride from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 14th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Lots and lots and lots of data-ish kind of stuff to recap this week. We've got some Fed minutes to digest as well. And oh, by the way, what is going on over in London? And does it actually matter? Amara Omokwe is at the Wall Street Journal. Kate Davidson's at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
So, Amara, let me start with you, and we'll do inflation first. The consumer price index, 8.2%, headline, 6.6% core, persistent, stubborn, sticky, relentless, take your pick. Were you surprised?
Yeah, it was surprising. Inflation, the CPI report came in much hotter than expected, even though we saw gas prices come down substantially last month. And I think that this pretty much kind of solidifies like what the Fed has been talking about in the last few weeks. They are really committed to bringing down inflation because it hasn't come down in a way that makes them feel like it's time to change course on this rate hike path that they've been on. And what we saw in the core inflation numbers in particular, mm-hmm. economists were talking about that a lot. And that word persistence was being thrown around a lot because of what we saw in the pickup in the core inflation, just really stoking those fears that this has become broad-based and could be sticking around a lot longer.
I thought it was interesting, Kate, that the big quote that came out of the minutes, which came out earlier this week from the Fed's most recent meeting, was that they are clearly, and in fact, they literally said this, we are more worried about undershooting, that is to say, easing off, than we are about overshooting, keeping interest rates high for longer.
Yeah, I mean, that's a message that you've seen them kind of increasingly yeah. lean into throughout the year. And I think what they're really trying to do here is make the case very clearly for why they're continuing to raise rates so aggressively. Yes, we can all see the inflation data, but you do have, as we've discussed before, Kai, really strong labor markets mm-hmm. still. And we saw this jobs report. Yes, the monthly job gains are starting to slow, but I mean, they are really strong given where you know the jobless rate is and given how high rates are. So, right. What's the reason for doing this? Well, the reason is they're just worried that if they back off too soon, if inflation could become entrenched. So they're trying to hammer home that message.
But Amara, let me ask you this. I mean, inflation expectations are still reasonably well anchored, right? The thing Powell talks about all the time mm-hmm. is he doesn't want those inflation expectations to get out of control, and they're not. Expectations are now for third quarter gross domestic product growth to be around 2%, the labor market's strong. How are we worrying about a recession when inflation expectations are anchored and the labor market is so strong?
Well, I think part of what is driving that concern for people who say perhaps the Fed shouldn't be as aggressive as it is right now, or maybe they should slow down, is that there hasn't necessarily been enough time, in their opinion, for the economy to digest what the Fed is doing, right? Mm-hmm. So people who are concerned about a recession are saying, look, the Fed has done 5 rate hikes this year. The last 3 have been really large. Perhaps we need a pause here to see how the economy is working through these rate hikes before we get even more large rate hikes. So I think that's the concern. Like, people aren't talking about a recession this year. They're talking about a recession perhaps next year as what the Fed is doing has its chance to make its way through the economy.
Right. Kate, those concerns, right, about that long and variable lag of monetary policy, we've gone from basically 0% interest rates to 3% in like 9 months, and it takes a long time for monetary policy to get through the economy. So we don't really know, right?
I think that's fair. And just to reiterate, I mean, there is so much weirdness in this economy. Yeah. I mean, coming out of a global pandemic, I know it feels like it's been forever, but we're still working through the kinks of that. There's a war in Europe that's causing all kinds of disruptions with energy prices and global supply chains. China has its zero COVID policy mm-hmm. and their economy is slowing. There are so many cross currents and so many complex factors with this economy. So the things that we have learned, or economists and policymakers have learned over decades of doing this work, it just really doesn't hold right now. They don't have that confidence in what these numbers mean and where their policy decisions are leading them, really.
Amara, am I going too far if I say the Fed's kind of flying blind? I mean, they've got a zillion PhD economists and they got more data than they know what to do with. But if you listen to Kate, it's just murky out there.
It is murky. And I think when you listen to Fed officials, they will acknowledge that there are risks. They will acknowledge that, you know, there could be a lot of pain to the economy from what they are doing. But they've also been very clear, as we've been talking about, that they feel like the risks of doing too little are way higher than the risks of doing too much. And so, yes, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of weirdness out there, but they are firmly committed to the path that they're on.
Kate, implicit in what the Fed is doing is that high inflation for a prolonged period of time is worse than a recession, right?
It's like pain now versus pain later. Pain now versus more pain later. Like that's really what they're trying to say, is not just, there are people that are urging them to kind of back off and see what happens. And the point that they're making is this: just stopping and starting, which is something that did happen during the 70s, the last time we had really elevated inflation, just kind of backing off as soon as you see some glimmer of improvement, that's just a recipe for prolonging the pain, right? They think it's much better to get it over and done with. It might be uncomfortable. It might be really uncomfortable right now. They hope it won't be, but it would be. They are really convinced. That is one thing that they, if they're flying blind, they are very, very convinced that if they wait longer, it just will mean more pain later. So that's what they want to avoid.
Got to trust your instruments. All right. So enough of our troubles. Let's go to the UK's troubles, Amara. And I want to ask about Liz Truss and the now former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, who was fired this morning. And the Prime Minister does a big U-turn on some of her policies. Mm-hmm. Make the case for me that Americans should be interested in what's going on there beyond just the train wreck of it.
Yeah, it has been a really weird couple of weeks in the UK. But I think one thing that's really interesting to me that has been raised by the situation in the UK is how are governments going to respond in this period where we have elevated inflation, we have central banks tightening, and we have slowing economic growth? Like one thing that Liz Truss and her cabinet were trying to do, they're trying to sort of stimulate growth because the UK has this big energy crisis and fears of a recession in the UK are really, really high. And they proposed all these tax cuts to try and kind of stimulate growth. And of course, there was this backlash in the financial markets because of that. And so I think it does raise questions. What are governments going to do if we do start to see a significant slowdown? What will lawmakers and the Biden administration here in the US do if we see a slowdown? Because administration officials have said, look, fiscal policy should really complement what the Fed is doing. So it does raise questions about what options would be available to them if we do see an economic slowdown and if we do see a weakening in the labor market.
Kate, super quick thoughts.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that sort of tension was on display too this week at the IMF and World Bank meetings, thinking about a global recovery, about domestic policies. But there's no real leader right now for a global economic rescue if the entire world is sort of melting down.
Kate Davidson at Politico, Amara Mokwe at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, that big algorithm-driven rally yesterday. Yeah, that was algorithmically undone today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm going to use a word now that is going to be sweet, sweet music to Jay Powell's ears if, he's listening. Disinflation. We talked about the CPI and all that a couple of minutes ago. Amara, Kate, and I did. And yes, overall prices are still going up. We have covered that. But we did get some data today that maybe kind of could be showing inflation cooling off in some parts of this economy. September retail sales were basically flat. Import prices were down. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Think of inflation as a runner. In parts of the economy, that runner is slowing down, still going forward, just not quite so fast. Gregory Dacco, chief economist at EY, says, like our runner, inflation is flagging a bit.
I think we're starting to see some indications in some sectors that prices are not rising as fast as they have been over the past year.
For example, the Labor Department reported today that prices for September imports rose 6% over the past year. That's the smallest year-over-year increase since February of 2021. Oxford Economics chief U.S. economist Kathy Bosjancic says even food prices lost a little momentum last month.
The pace of inflation, food and price year-over-year, did slow. So it was 11.4 in August, and it slowed to 11.2 in September.
This all sounds good, but inflation isn't cooling across the board. Going back to our runner metaphor, in this economy, there are like a million different runners, and they're not all slowing down. So while inflation is fading just a touch for food, prices for services are still shooting up. Gary Hoover is an economist at Tulane University.
It's one of the more baffling things that is happening in this economy, and it's got to be a combination of pandemic and other geopolitical factors that are taking place.
Things like the war in Ukraine, which doesn't fit into any economic model. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of food, as Nancy was there for a second, the grocery bill today comes to $24.6 billion. Inflation? I mean, maybe, but actually that's what Kroger's going to pay to buy Albertsons in a deal that A, might shake up the whole industry, B, might lower your grocery bill, or C, might do neither. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on the M&A desk today.
Kroger has about 2,700 supermarkets in the U.S. Albertsons has about 2,200.
You combine that together, and that's basically on par with Walmart's brick-and-mortar footprint.
Blake Drosch is with Insider Intelligence. Walmart would still be number one in sales, he says, but Kroger becomes a bigger competitor with more bargaining power over its suppliers. There are some not-so-obvious benefits, too. Bobby Gibbs is with management consulting from Oliver Wyman. He says consolidating can improve a grocer's credit rating.
If you look at a lot of the kind of largest conventional grocers, their credit ratings are not nearly as strong as some of the non-traditional food players.
If Kroger gets bigger, it can get cheaper loans. More stores also means more people ordering from Kroger's website and more ad revenue. But what does this all mean for our grocery bills? Very unclear. Ricky Volpe is assistant professor at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. He says some studies suggest more consolidated food markets bring higher prices, but those studies are many decades old.
We know very little quantitatively about the impacts of mergers and acquisitions specifically on food prices and sort of how that affects consumers.
But with Sam's Clubs and Costco's lurking in the background, the grocery industry is pretty cutthroat on prices, says Gibbs at Oliver Wyman.
A lot of the more value-oriented players in the market have really created a lot of pressure for some of the larger grocers to kind of keep their prices down from where they might be otherwise.
Competition and prices are among the things the Federal Trade Commission will be looking at as it decides whether to approve the deal. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I find myself looking at the other bikers going slowly and going, just get out of my way.
A little controversy there on the bike paths. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 403 points today. 1.3% closed at 29,634. Yeah, I hesitated because I'm not sure how I feel about the Wawas today. I don't know. NASDAQ down 327, 3%. Finished at 10,321. S&P 500 down 86 points, 2.3%. 35 and 83. Okay, fine. Yes, the Wawas. For the week, though, the Dow up 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 3.1%. S&P 500 down 1.5%. Banks reported earnings today. One takeaway, consumers are using their credit cards more and taking out more bank loans. PNC says its total loans are 9% more than a year ago. Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, and Citigroup all indicated that they are preparing for potential loan defaults, even though revenue is up and current losses are low. JP Morgan Chase climbed 1.8% today. Citigroup up 0.6%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, get this, 4.02%. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Chinese Communist Party's 20th National People's Congress convenes Sunday in Beijing. President Xi Jinping and 2,300 or so of his closest party colleagues will gather too. Unless something completely unexpected happens, they will give Xi a third term running the second biggest economy in the world. He's been in power since 2012, but the last couple of years in particular, with Beijing's zero COVID policy and its crackdown on the technology and real estate industries, have had some real impact. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has more now on what that's been like.
Let's go back to pre-COVID times, June 2019, in the eastern Chinese city of Hangzhou, a tech hub. I was grabbing lunch with Zheng Jinghao. He's a user interface or UI designer. He says he's used to working 16, 17 hours a day. He even had a fold-out chair to sleep at his desk.
The fold-out chair was for everyone. The company called it a so-called employee benefit. What kind of benefit was that?
Some experts say long work hours is partly why you might have heard of Chinese tech giants in the U.S., like ByteDance, the company behind TikTok. Zheng Jinghao, among others, pushed for more humane work hours. That fizzled when the economy was hit with the COVID-19 pandemic.
A contagious smile, a heart of gold.
English tutor Tony Du had a tutoring center in central Hunan province. It reopened 4 months after the initial COVID outbreak in 2020. Business was as competitive as ever, he says. Some parents asked him to guarantee results for their children.
Sometimes we have to guarantee how much score they have to get in their final exam.
How can you guarantee that a student would get that score?
So this is not an absolute promise.
China's government accused tutoring companies of overstating the results they could deliver and preying on anxious parents.
There was a rumor,
says Tony Du, that a big policy change was coming. But he thought the government might crack down for a bit, then let the industry rebound, like before.
But this time, it's very different.
Different because the current policy has all but crushed the tutoring industry. Share prices of the top Chinese education firms plummeted in the New York Stock Exchange last year. They've not recovered. Same for some tech giants. China's government fined major firms for being monopolistic and for violating cybersecurity laws. Then came mass layoffs.
One company I worked at wanted to cut 1,500 jobs, but it ended up laying off 3,000 people.
Again, UI designer Zheng Jinghao. He survived the layoff, but he's now left the tech industry. As for China's property market, people have predicted for years that the bubble would burst. But it was hard to believe, says entrepreneur Shane Wu.
Lots of people have made money by speculating on the property market. Friends of mine earned hundreds of thousands of dollars doing that. That's not a ton, but it would take them a long time to earn that much with a regular job.
At one point, he had three properties in Yanjiao Town, a 40-minute drive to downtown Beijing.
At the time, I thought if my business ventures failed, I would still have my properties. I could sell them to start over again, but it didn't work out that way.
His business ventures went bad. Then last year, he had to sell and auction all his properties at below market value. The housing market is even worse now that China has made it harder for developers to get easy credit. These industries needed to be reined in, says Carrie Brown, a professor of Chinese studies at King's College in London. But are the policies too harsh?
The Communist Party's social contract is that as long as people materially, their lives are getting better, then they'll stick with what they've got in terms of the government. What's not so clear is how much pain they'll take before they do anything. If you kind of want to boot out a government anywhere, it's not easy. And in China, it's super, super, super not easy.
As for English tutor Tony Du, he closed his tutoring center last year and moonlighted as a motorcycle taxi driver for a bit. But he's got dreams. One inspired by the TV drama Boston Legal. He's decided he's going to save up to study law in the U.S. I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Back in August, I saw this article in The Atlantic. It was kind of a critical analysis of e-bikes, emphasis here on the critical. It was, shall we say, a not uncontroversial piece. E-bikes are going to be the key, or one of the keys anyway, to the future of transportation. But feelings about them right now, they run hot and cold. Ian Bogost is the director of the program in film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He is also the author of said polarizing piece. Mr. Bogost, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
All right, so I'm going to quote you to yourself here. A cyclist I have never been, but perhaps an e-biker I could become. Discuss.
I really wanted to ride to work, you know. I don't want to drive in anymore. Yeah. I thought the e-bike would be a good way to do it where I could get some exercise. I could be outside, but it wouldn't be all sweaty when I got there.
And yet, you have some misgivings.
Well, you know, the devices are incredible. And I certainly do get there without being sweaty, and it's fast and kind of scary, actually.
Yeah.
And I think the thing I realized when I got my e-bike was that it wasn't just a bicycle that was kind of souped up, and it's certainly not yet a motorcycle. It's kind of a whole different beast.
Well, you call it a chameleon, right? And it incorporates the best and also the worst aspects of various modes of transportation.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about some of those features of bikes that you really love, like, you know, it's quiet and you can be outdoors and, you know, you're not producing carbon emissions, those are present. But then some of the downsides, too. It's, you know, with the e-bike, you're motorized. So all that sense of, like, getting exercise or being physically active is somewhat changed and downplayed. And, you know, you also turn into a little bit of a jerk on a bike in general and an e-bike in particular. And I find myself looking at the other bikers going slowly and going, just get out of my way.
Wow. It really did turn you into a jerk.
Yeah, it kind of did, you know, and I was thinking about it too. You know, the way that the transit and transit infrastructure kind of works, and, you know, a lot of bike advocates will say, it's not about the bikes, it's just about the infrastructure. Get the paths and get the roads and get the cars off of them, and then we can go. But in some ways, any kind of multimodal transport where you've got, you know, joggers and people pushing strollers and people on normal bikes and people on e-bikes all together, it's going to create problems because those kinds of transit modalities, they don't mix as easily as we might like to think, especially in America.
We ought to be clear here. And I so cards on the table. I ride mountain bikes up in the hills early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I see people on e-bikes up there with me on the trails. And I'm like, yeah. Come on, man, you're not really riding a bike.
You know, I felt this way. I thought it was really cool at first. I was like bragging to my friends and my colleagues, hey, I got an e-bike, I'm riding in. And they were like, oh, you know, I didn't expect that reaction. But yeah, it was definitely there. I think there's a sense that there's something illegitimate about e-bikes. And, you know, many of the bike advocates have told me, well, you know, just slough it off. You know, don't worry about it. Do what you're going to do. But that's not really how we work in America, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not. It is true that some people in this economy simply can't ride bikes, mobility issues, what have you. And this is an avenue for them.
It is. There's a lot of folks who, you know, for whatever reason, have a difficult time riding a bike. And an e-bike gives them, you know, a leg up, as it were. You don't have to pedal as hard. And as long as you're pedaling, then the bike kind of transports you along. And some of the higher end devices have a throttle even.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about biking, I think it's important to distinguish biking as a hobby, biking as a sport, biking as exercise from biking as commuting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just don't always make all of those distinctions. There's a lot going on in the bike universe.
Are you going to stick with it?
Yeah, you know, I rode in today. I've been riding it. It's I like it, but it's strange. And I think resolving that strangeness is, you know, something that we need to work on collectively over time.
Ian Bogost, he's the director of the program in film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis, also an e-biker. Mr. Bogost, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, Rafael Bostic, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and an occasional guest on this program, said today that he had failed to properly disclose financial transactions, mutual funds primarily, covering his 5 years running the bank. Bostic said he hadn't properly understood the Fed's disclosure rules and that the trades were executed by a third-party money manager. Fed Chair Jay Powell has asked the central bank's inspector general to investigate. You will remember the presidents of the Boston and Dallas regional feds resigned last year after it became public that they had been trading heavily in individual stocks in 2020. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, which I will preface by saying the people running Harvard University's endowment probably do check their statements every single day, something most of us definitely should not be doing. Anyway, saw this on CNN. Despite what one assumes to be very well-compensated money managers, Harvard's endowment lost $2.3 billion in fiscal year 2022. It's a 1.8% drop, brings it down to a measly $50.9 billion. Of course, the S&P is still down more than 25% from its high, so, you know, maybe not so bad. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.